when brands set up a code of conduct in place and say that, okay, if this factory does not align to our minimum wage payment that we have set, if they're not aligning with my code of conduct as a brand, I will not work with this supplier. It's huge. I think that definitely pushes the suppliers as well, or the factory owners, to make more conscious choices and to actually just align. Because if they need this contract, they will have to align.
Welcome to the 15th episode of the Ikiri Podcast Season 2. In this episode, we have with us Aishwarya Sharma, India's first fashion activist who focuses on using fashion as a medium of change through her social media platforms and passionately advocates for climate and women's rights. In this episode, we speak with her about her journey to becoming a fashion activist, the storytelling aspect of writing about social issues on her platform, and the projects she's working on currently. She also speaks with us about how Indian fashion is compared to global standards in terms of sustainability, how its perception is changing amongst the international audience, and the issues around sustainability and ethical practices in India. This was such an engaging and eye-opening conversation for us, and we're so excited for you to tune in.
Thank you so much, Aishwarya, for having this conversation with us. I'm excited to hear about your opinion about India in the global scenario in terms of sustainability, in terms of fashion, where we stand, where we are in terms of global sustainable practices and those kind of things. So my first question to you before we actually dive into our conversation is, can you tell us a little bit more about your journey becoming a fashion activist and sustainability advocate and all that you do currently?
Yes. So thank you so much, Nivi, for having me on this podcast. I was very excited to join you and talk about, things from a perspective, also from a social media activist, a digital activist that I've, and this page that I've created, but also, to touch upon how sustainability is the need of the hour and why young people also need to be way more indulged in it than we are right now in just terms of sustainability. My blog, I actually started this in 2018 with a small blog on WordPress. So I didn't really have an Instagram back then. I just had a WordPress blog as part of my new media project in the last year of my college. And I was pursuing my bachelor's in journalism. So my teacher said that, why don't you start a new media blog? You have to have a blog, Aishwarya, because you need to write something on it. And, it just started from like that kind of suggestion. And I wanted to talk a lot about how fashion is a medium of change for many, many people. For I was working with Stop Acid Attacks at that point in time as a volunteer. Mm-hmm. And if you're aware as well, in 2016, Miss Lakshmi, who's an acid attack survivor herself, walked the London Fashion Week. So that was kind of a reckoning, the tryst with how fashion is being used as a medium for people, who come from different backgrounds or are marginalized or are the victims or the survivors, and how they are using this medium to tell their stories. So I think that storytelling aspect of this field impacted too much, in my personal life as well. And it just like felt personal writing about acid attacks through the medium of this fashion blog that I'd had at that point in time. And that was also my first successful viral campaign in 2018, which, received more than 72,000 views in the first few hours. And then it just like went over like lakhs of views in a few days time. And I mean, in terms of today, if you compare 2018, things weren't that popular. So the videos, even if you see Instagram's horizontal format, it wasn't like a very, it wouldn't get you like so many views, it wouldn't like make you viral just because, So if you compare it with the reels today, reels are crossing like millions of views, from people all over the world. But back in time, that was like a huge thing for, something like this to just go viral. And it was also a moment of me for reflection as to how this medium could be used to talk about, social issues and social injustices that exist, especially towards women in the society, and how we can completely, change the narrative of fashion in terms of being a frivolous industry. Because if you come from an Indian household, which we do, if you say that you're from fashion, you are automatically considered a frivolous person, because fashion is in the very default mindset, Indian mindset. It is a frivolous industry. It has always been considered, she's a model, or he's a model, or they're from fashion. So it's considered not an industry which could be compared to other professions like engineering or doctor or those kind of medical, those kind of professions. So just to be in this and changing that narrative that fashion is much more than what meets the eye, and how we can truly impact this industry, and how we can just use it to our advantage as a society, I think that was my first reckoning with just starting this blog, which then turned pretty infamous, to be honest, because I was just at 8,000-9,000 followers on my Instagram from college and my community and known people. And then after that video went viral, I crossed almost 35k followers on Instagram. And so I never looked back. I think it started really from there, about how this could be a medium for change, for a bigger change. And since then, I started working with brands, and I started bridging the gap between brands and the NGOs and CSR partners. So it was more to bridge the gap between marginalized voices and the marginalized people, and how brands, who are richer in terms of resources, could use, could help these people, in turn. So it was more on those lines. When we started realizing that climate is also a huge part in terms of what fashion is and, what sustainability today means. So I think as a person in this industry, I'm also navigating my way through how to advocate this the best and how to learn more every day. Because I don't believe every person knows everything. We are all learning every day. Of course. And I'm very excited to sort of, establish that as a fact that fashion activism could exist as a whole legitimate career. And it's not something which is, it is unconventional, but I want to pave that path for other people to join in. So they shouldn't be facing the many, many challenges that I faced, because the biggest criticism that I've received, doing this, is that fashion and activism should be separated, because if it's serious, then it's not fashion, and if it's fashion, then it's not serious. So there is no way that these two are coming together. So what is she saying? So I think it's just so it's been a lot about that, but I'm happy now that sustainability is growing in terms of importance, and in the very complexity is being diminished, and being diminished to the fact that it can coexist with style, which is the ultimate kind of goal. And I'm happy that now things are changing. And so there's that.
Yeah, I am very curious about, the active projects that you're doing, and in terms of your profile and how you're, reaching a certain community. But before we get into that, I would love to talk about the video that went viral, and who are these people that kind of became part of your community? And the reason I'm asking is not what made it viral, but more from a point of view as to, in 2018, was this in 2018? Yeah.
Yeah,
who was this audience that was interested in the video that you created, or in the content that you created? Because that shows promise, right?
Absolutely.
So who is that person that kind of came into your community?
Most of my audience, I told you, I was working with Stop Acid Attack Foundation at that point in time. And they have this incredible cafe called Shiro's in Agra and Lucknow as well. So I visited the cafe, I was visiting survivors, and meeting them was it had a huge impact on my life. Because all that they said to me is that, people come here to know our stories all the time, ranging from journalists, news media, what happened, how it happened, this, that, whatever. And I think at this point, we're just tired of talking about what happened to us. If you know what happened to us, you can just read about it, because, 100 people have recorded this for people to view all the time. But what we want to say, if we could say something different this time, is that we just need people to have empathy towards us, to not look at us from a sympathetic, angle. Because when you do that, you're putting yourself above us, and then there is no equality. So what we want is that if I go out in the sun, if I'm just walking down the street, I want you to look at me normally, or maybe just look away like you would to any other stranger, and not stop or be disgusted or be shocked, or because that makes us relive everything as to what really happened. So my campaign, the video of which went viral was Flowers Not Scars, because they don't look at it as something which is which they have to carry on for the rest of their life, as something which is a regressive thing, but they're embracing it to be what happened to them. And despite that happening to them, they are living their life and, you know, going forward. So it actually had, in that video, I had flowers being hand-painted on all over my body. And it circulated around the idea. So, you know, why I say storytelling is so important, because it captures the consumer's eye within seconds. It has the ability to hold conversations. And that's what we wanted to do through that video. So, you know, when you start watching it, you don't understand what's happening. But the more you dive into it completely, you understand that, okay, this is a reflection of something more. You know, it's saying something more. It's telling a story. And what story is it? It's the story of acid attack survivor and every survivor who has gone through a heinous attack like that. And they still choose to embrace themselves every day, despite how hard and just suffocating that it sounds. So that was the video. A lot of young people supported it, to be honest. A lot of young people supported it. Mm-hmm. My entire audience range is mostly 61% women, which is from the ages of 18 to somewhere 26. And, then there are men. But I think the audience this spoke most to were young people. Mm-hmm. People, you know, because I was in college, I could see the impact that it had around me, you know, my age, peers, even junior, proud and everybody, basically. And yeah, so that was like quite a reckoning for me that young people care about this kind of stuff, because I didn't know that they did. I thought it's just me, you know, caring a lot about this, or it's probably had an impact on my life, so I'm doing this for a certain purpose. But then I realized that it could be a collective response to, you know, a collective response from young people to what's happening around.
Definitely. I think that there is a lot of change that is happening, especially also in the fashion industry. With the younger generation, they are the ones asking the questions. They are the ones demanding change from larger organizations and actually making some progress. Not just in India, I would think worldwide as well, because it is going to affect their generation and their lives directly. So definitely, I think that they are the ones kind of leading the change for us. And of course, with people like you leading the change, it's exciting to see where we're headed. So now going back to your platform, and I know it kind of has been touching upon different things, but what is that one goal you have with your platform? Or with your community?
I think the one goal, I actually spoke about this very, very recently, is that one goal, I feel like, you know, there's this saying that impacts me like so much, is that when your vision is clear, strategy becomes easy. And the vision and the ultimate goal is to achieve peace through fashion. And that I speak in the very global terms of everything that fashion accounts for: peace within, you know, oneself. If I dress up, if it's making me feel peaceful, or if I'm at peace, you know, wearing what I'm wearing, or if people who have made my clothes are at peace making my clothes, has this supported human rights around the world? Has this supported health sector around the world? How has fashion, which is something which is so default, just intertwined with the very nerves of every human being on this planet, realizing it or not realizing it directly, how does this impact the entire world? So I think one goal that I have is to achieve ultimate peace through fashion.
I love that. I really love that. I hope we're able to achieve it together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's such a great vision to have, and we're in all support for all that you do. Can you, in your opinion, can you tell us how the Indian fashion industry compares to global standards when it comes to sustainable and ethical practices?
I think, we were having this conversation very recently at like a table discussion where people came from a lot of different opinions as to how, you know, Indian fashion is growing, or is this becoming a major disruptor now, or is this like how is it being viewed? And with the many, many opinions came the realization that Indian fashion, in terms of pure, just sustainability, has always been not just at par, but above and beyond everything, right? So I'm not saying it just because, you know, I come from this country, so, you know, I'm being biased, but because I come from this from this country, I understand and I have seen things around me, you know, being sustainable way before we even realized that sustainability was a thing or a buzzword or new kind of thing. We never realized it because we have always had it. If you see, you know, through generations, and if we date back to ancient times as to when it really started and the designs and the style and, you know, the textile originality and just, you know, the authenticity of our fabrics from this country can be traced back to as old as civilization, you know, as old as Indus Valley civilization or a Mohenjo-Daro or a Harappa. You know, if you see the designs and what it came from, what women wore, what men wore, it all sort of spanned from there, you know, through the Mughal Empire times, through the sari invention of saris and how it became a trend with, you know, like, the entire, basically, if you look at the entire line of where it came from and where it went, it actually became very circular for us. So now that we talk about circular fashion, I look back at my own country for inspiration and I see that a sari which was given to my mom by her mom has been given to her mom by her, grandmother. So how many generations has this sari been passed down on, and what is the life circle of this sari? So can we tell the global brands that, hey, I have a piece in this wardrobe which is as old as 70 years and this is still alive. Its life cycle is not even complete. It's still alive in terms of being reworn, you know, probably through me or generations after me. So can we look at how this happened? So I think when we talk about Indian fashion in global terms, I feel that all that we have to see as Indians and probably, you know, as a whole world is that how we can go to our own roots, you know, back to our roots, how we did things, you know, what we started doing that made us, that derailed us from our own kind of culture or our from own kind of idea of sustainability. Because if you trace it back, if you go back to your roots, you'll find you've always been sustainable. This country has been sustainable in terms of their fashion choices, in terms of their food choices. You know, most people still eat on a leaf in many rural areas and in many different regions of this country, because mostly people in this country still live in rural areas. So if you look at them, you would understand that there is a concept where even having less is making more out of it. They've always made more out of what they had, even when they had less, even if they continue to have less. So why it can become a whole kind of, you know, political economic debate. What I'm trying to sort of just reflect upon here is that Indian fashion in terms of global industry has always been so sustainable. So I think that is why we are seeing the shift and the change from how global industry is now looking at Indian roots and Indian designers and Indian makers as to see how they kind of do things. Let's be real, you know, a top that you wear today from a fast fashion company wouldn't even last that event long. So what is it that we are doing wrong, right? So I think it's definitely like a whole conversation and a whole kind of arguments. But at the end, it remains that Indian fashion has always been living sustainability through its very kind of nerve. And I think now is the time to look back upon it for the world and for us ourselves, to be honest, is that how can we go back to our roots while still maintaining what we learned over the years?
Yeah.
So nobody's saying that, you know, go back to the ancient times and wear the same sari in the same way. Because as women, we have embraced our own style. Modern Indian women today are like, you know, they're embracing their own style, their own culture, their own storytelling through what they wear. And, you know, an accessory that's important to me, but I want to style it with a blazer and a pant. And how we can like live through that culture, keep it alive and be our own best self, which is like the most sustainable when it comes to an Indian person.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I feel like there is a percentage of us that are kind of looking back, preserving, embracing it, inculcating it in our current scenario as a modern day woman. What do you think the perspective is like from a global perspective? So say, what do people think of India now? Earlier we used to talk about how people internationally would think that we still ride elephants and do all of those typical things, right? But what do you think is the perspective now from an international point of view?
I think it's changed drastically. You're right. From like a time that we were considered, you know, people who are, you know, just the land of elephants or the land of, now it's become a land of innovation, land of renewable energy, land of, you know, where people make their own choices, or, you know, they are not afraid to say who they are to the rest of the world. And I think that is a contribution of not just one person, but many, many people, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people and change makers and even leaders, you know, who have paved that way, who have gone to international kind of context and still maintain their cultural value while showing what Indians could do. We've sent Chandrayaan, you know, one of the first countries to be the most successful landing in a particular region on moon, which no other country has been able to do until now. So it's not just fashion, you know, which has changed or drastically changed over the years. It is the perception of Indians and the many, many Indians who are behind it. So if you look, so I was like sort of researching on the women who made this project happen with Chandrayaan, and all that they wore are simple saris. These are simple women living just their simple best life, wearing Indian saris and no fuss about it. And they could be the most brilliant minds in the world. So I think that is the true representation of us as an Indian, is that we could be looking as simple as it could get and we could still have the most brilliant mind in the world. So nothing about our kind of dressing or about our ethnic kind of culture or the way we dress has to say about what we can do. We can wear a sari and still send a mission to the moon, or you know, a charter to the moon, or like, it's I think it's in every aspect brilliant that they showed that no fuss about anything, you know, to them, but the very resilience in the mind and their vision. So I think beyond everything, we have to look at people for who they are. And I think this has happened due to many, many people involved who have, you know, gone through a lot and made it possible for us to not just be limited by what we wear. Because for many, many years, we were limited by how we dressed or how we look. And that's also like one of the reasons why we moved towards the Western culture of, you know, wearing something Western and looking more Western. So if you look more Western, people think that, she knows better, or he knows better, you know, he can speak English. So he definitely has the better education. But if you look at these simple people, this is like the best reflection and the best example of what you could do while still not knowing a foreign language, maybe, or yeah, maybe knowing it, but not being limited by what you wear or what you know, but because of what you can do. So So I think it's changed drastically today that I've gone to places like I go to these international conferences for climate and whatnot. And even if I don't wear a sari, I don't have to prove myself, you know, just because I'm wearing a sari, I'm an Indian, you know, because as an Indian woman, we have emerged from just being looked at a certain way to now owning what we wear while still saying our mind out loud. And I think that is a true form of empowerment that fashion has given to most people. Yeah.
And I completely agree with you. I really like your thoughts on representing India in different ways. What is your opinion, or how would you want to position yourself? Because it's all about positioning and packaging and presenting yourselves at these international conferences, for example, right? How, because for us, I believe, like IKIVI, for example, one of the things that we value and we want to do with IKIVI is put India on the map in terms of Indian contemporary fashion. And that's something that's very, very important to me, because I feel like in terms of quality, in terms of aesthetic, in terms of design, we're on par, if not better, in terms of, you know, a lot of these different traditional techniques and crafts and things like that. So that's something that we want to do personally. And it's all about positioning, you know, what we have, and also trying to work with the perspective of this international community that they have on India. How do you present and market? Is it something that you think about in terms, because you are a representative from India, is that something that you think about at all? And is that something that you focus on?
I think I used to earlier. I used to earlier think a lot about, you know, how I will be sort of represented, or because I come from, you know, a certain kind of country. We come from Global South. So if you go to conferences, you know, these kind of conferences where everybody is coming from every part of the world, there's definitely, you know, like Global South and then Global North. And then how you are represented from the Global South really mattered in a lot of ways. But I think with just understanding how people work and how people actually look at it, I've just like completely gone away from the idea of looking like what is, according to you, a typical Indian? Because, you know, people have come up to me and said, oh, but you don't look like a typical Indian, you know. Oh, are you from India? Oh, because, you know, we thought that, okay, sure. And, you know, my only sort of reply to that is that what, according to you, is a typical Indian? And how is, because what, according to me, is a typical American? It could have many, many different ways of looking at how Americans are. I mean, definitely, you know, the fact that all of us, you know, would come from the same nationality. But even after coming from the same country, we all could be completely different people in like so many ways. So mm-hmm. What is your idea of a typical kind of, you know, Indian that you're looking at? Or am I not fitting into your idea of, you know, what an Indian should look like, right? Because that definitely sort of, you know, gives you an idea that you need to like probably wear something which says that, you know, I come from this ethnicity, or, you know, this is my ethnic dressing, or this is what. So the point here is that we want to move away from just being, again, you know, limited by our own thoughts. Because why do I have to only dress in a certain way to say I am from here? And why can I not be from here and still fit into your idea of what a typical Indian or a typical UAE person or a typical African person should look like, right? Mm-hmm. So when you do that, you're stereotyping us into a box. You're saying that this is what Africans, you know, look like. This is people from UAE look like. And this is what people from India, you know, who look like this. So if somebody doesn't fit that box, then there are questions, you know, around that. Okay, you're not. Okay, sure. So I feel that that's very stereotypical, and people really need to move away from the idea, because we as a country have. Mm-hmm. I see all my friends looking completely different from each other and being completely comfortable, you know, in who they are and where they come from, and there are no barriers. And I think that's what we want to say. So whenever I go to these conferences, I move away from, you know, putting myself under the pressure of wearing something which should reflect where I come from, but by saying something which definitely speaks for my people. You know, I want to speak about my people, about what happens in our factories, about what affects my country as a nation, what are our hopes, dreams, and what do we want as youth of India. But we don't want to be categorized in a certain looking shape or a dressing manner to be saying that. So mm-hmm. I definitely want to move away. So this is what I do. Whenever I go, I try to be myself, which is not, you know, their idea of what I should be. And I think that's the biggest form of rebellion I have going on for me, is that no, you cannot put us in a box. You know, yeah. You don't have to put us in a box. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for listening to the Ikibi podcast. If you are enjoying listening to our podcast, do consider supporting us by visiting www.ikibi.com. That is IKKIVI.com. We are a small sustainable business supporting contemporary Indian brands. Our platform is run by an all-women team, handpicking the most beautiful, ethically made clothes and accessories from across the country, all in one place. Our podcast is self-funded and will always be free to listen to. You supporting our work would mean a lot to us. Thank you for being here, and let's get back to our episode. Mm-hmm. So I want to go into, you know, the production and sustainability aspect of the fashion industry within India. We talk a lot about Bangladesh and China. I'd love to hear what your opinion, in your opinion, are the major issues that we're currently facing in terms of sustainability and in terms of ethical practices in the country of India.
I think maybe it's more to do with you know, economic regulations in our country and political inclinations, you know, of a country at what point in time. And while all those that could get, you know, deeper and more integrated with any conversation that can happen, I feel that, you know, there is exploitation. It is no news that, you know, how factory workers are exploited. The entire human rights issue, even how you said, arised probably from Bangladesh. It sort of, you know, came from that kind of Rana Plaza incident in 2013. It completely changed the fashion narrative for the rest of the world for, you know, years to come, as, you know, this has happened. And not that it wasn't happening before that, but It just came to light because this unfortunate incident sort of blew up, killing more than 1,100 people, mostly women and children. So people had to look at it, you know, they were made to look at it from a single kind of very being very single-minded about it. But I do think that, you know, in terms of just manufacturing and how, you know, we come from a country where labor is cheap. We do have lesser kind of, or maybe, or best to say, more vague kind of laws. And I think the biggest problem is that people are not aware about their own rights. If you talk to, because I have spoken to a lot of factory workers in the past, and, you know, people who are involved in the business of making what's being made, even in our factories, you know, around the country, the thing that they are not aware about is human rights. You know, they're not aware. So if you are in a situation and you do not know that something is wrong, if you don't really understand or realize that I am being treated unjustly, you will never be able to. So that's where I think the world cuts these people from, because people tend to cut them from awareness. And I think that is also one of the biggest things why I do what I do, is to have as much more awareness as I can have on my platform. You know, not because a factory worker is reading what I'm doing, but maybe a business owner is reading what I'm doing or what I'm saying. And maybe when he goes to do something or put up a factory in place, he will know that there are people who are aware about these things and who could come at them and say that, hi, this is not how you will treat these people, you know, who cannot speak for themselves. But I think, you know, knowing and, you know, just the lack of motivation and the lack of even creating a union, because if you see, some governments prevents you from even making unions first place. So even if I want to do something about it, I am not allowed to have a union or a trade union or a workers group right to myself. So what do I do when I'm in those situations? So in India, you know, we talk about the alternative to a fast fashion problem, which is a textile circular economy. Because India is a rich, you know, we have a rich culture. We come from a place as diverse as it could be, with people from as diverse backgrounds. And we are so rich in textiles that has been our very source of Indian fashion, in terms of linen, in terms of organic cotton, in terms of, you know, khadi, which is being going around the world like a wave right now, you know, the khadi, a fabric that many people did not even know existed. And we are masters of that as a country. But the biggest fact is that while our textile are one of the most sought after textile in the world right now, we are also the third largest producer of textile waste around the globe. You know, of 13 million, I think the 13 million tons of waste is just being produced in India alone, which is a 25% of the global waste that's being produced by a textile economy. So we're not just that we are the first in that, but we are also, you know, the third country which is producing the most waste in the textile. So how are we looking to solve that problem? Because if we are also the most sought after for a textile kind of for our textiles, you know, so there are definitely more opportunities for workers. There are more opportunities for being probably more factories in place, which produces, you know, textiles, which manufactures it and still have a low carbon footprint on the world. Because that is the point of having something, you know, which is a khadi or a linen or an organic cotton. It ultimately has the lowest kind of carbon footprint that's known in the industry right now. But we also have a huge problem of waste. And everything that comes from having that huge problem of, because we cannot keep that out of landfills. And once this is going into the landfills, the problem begins for the rest of the country, for people who are living near those landfills, you know, with many, many things that it basically exposes them to. So I think it definitely is like a major problem, even in our country. You know, we look at Vietnam, we look at Bangladesh, we look at countries where these international brands have set up their factories, but it's not that they are not here. They're here as well. They're producing clothes, they're manufacturing clothes, you know, at a rate which is faster. There's definitely exploitation. And as much as I think at the end of the day, where is the awareness around it? Do we know, mm-hmm. do we even can spot, can I get somebody from the industry to spot five places that these factories are being set up at and what is their human rights score as a factory? So I think that is a limitation of us as an industry, because if you look at fashion industry and the makers of this industry within itself, they're also super less aware about how labor is working. Because
yeah,
it is a big gap and unfortunate. And while, you know, I could be one person who could be saying this, at the end of the day, we need more people who can actually sort these kind of permissions to actually go and, you know, have these conversations and maybe have more awareness around this topic. So that definitely is, you know, a thing that we are working on, to be honest. I'm working with many, many international brands currently, you know, where we are like, okay, can we solve this problem? Or, you know, this is our, where the things are being produced, being manufactured for us. This is our Indian outlet. And this is what happens here. How can we have lesser impact? How can we have greener practices or maybe adoption of greener technologies? Will your, you know, how will the system change if we do that?
That's very promising that there are brands that are actually trying to make that change. What are some of the changes that they're trying to make?
I think adoption of renewable energy sources, switching to green energy, which, you know, I had a question with one of the brands and I said that, but that involves so much funding. It's at the end of the day, you have to look at it. It's not either or, right? It's yeah. like, you have to do this. You have to invest so much, you know. So are you willing to do that? Are you willing to go for a net zero emission, let's say, in terms with SDGs 2030 agenda, or mm-hmm. keep in line, you know, the 1.5 degree Paris Agreement, which is well known to every brand, you know, and especially the huge brands who are definitely also somewhere a part of this, accomplices in what's happened. So are you... will you be able to invest so much? Because if you look at the governments to do this for you, that's like a long battle, and we need solutions right now. If you say that, oh, we are in talks with the government, we know how governments work around the world. This would take years for you to even, you know, get any kind of funding from them for what? What are you trying to exactly do according to them or for them? So if you are a brand who has set up a factory in my country, and you use the cheap labor over the years, and the profit that you have made, the unimaginable profit that you have made, you know, because you get cheap labor so cheap in these countries. So now, are you, now that this has dawned upon you, will you be able to invest?
Are they?
As much as it requires, even if it means, you know, losses for you in the shorter kind of, you know, span. Because I think most brands that I've spoken with, they've always been like, I think it just makes sense. It is good business acumen. It makes sense right now to invest in these technologies, to adopt renewable energy sources. Because in the long term, as a businessman, I can calculate my numbers. I can yeah. see how production goes into it, how much manufacturing cost this will come at, and what will be my net revenue. So even mm-hmm. if it's probably, you know, lessened for a shorter period of time while the entire transition sort of goes from A to B, at the end of the day, I will come out of this victorious. So I think this awareness, this very fact that switching to sustainability and adoption of these energy sources makes sense, I think that's a sentiment that needs to go around, that needs to spread across every segment, not just fashion, I think every segment.
But there is that awareness. And I mean, definitely we see it globally as well, that the awareness and people and companies adopting these methods of production. But it's nice to hear that people are actually willing to invest from point of view.
I think also from a perspective that as a supplier, so for example, if I am a supplier with a brand and I don't follow the many areas that they have specified that this will work on, I will probably not get a contract. Mm-hmm. So I think that definitely makes a lot of difference when brands set up a code of conduct in place and say that, okay, if this factory does not align to our minimum wage payment that we have said should be given to workers, or if they are not using the plastic-free packaging, if they're not aligning with my code of conduct as a brand, I will not work with this supplier. So I think that's also a great kind of...
That's huge.
I think that definitely pushes the suppliers as well, or the factory owners, to make more conscious choices and to actually just align. Because if they need this contract, they will have to align with this kind of, code of conduct with a brand that they are trying to work with. So I think that's definitely a lot of, and this only comes maybe with awareness, with how much we can push, you know, as people, just as ordinary layman people, how much can we demand better for everyone around us?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. This is great to hear from a larger business perspective. And we know that for change to happen within the industry, we do need these large players to make these changes. But from a small business point of view, are there any aspects of the business that we can change to be more sustainable and ethical in the way we run our businesses? In the fashion industry, of course.
No, I think they're definitely showing us the way. I sometimes, you know, when brands reach out to me and say that, Ishwara, is there like a way, or what do you think? And I'm like, okay, you know, I think it's you who's paving the way for even the bigger brands and showing them that businesses could also be set up in this way. Because when a big brand, which is now huge, started, they started from a completely different kind of model. And now there are these small scale brands, medium scale brands, homegrown brands, so many of them only in India that I've had the ultimate pleasure to work with and see how they do things and how they treat people and how they treat people that they work with. And it's brilliant to just see them paving that way for the business, to show businesses that, you know, things could also be set up in a circular way from the beginning. So the investment may be more, you know, the investment, of course, a plastic wrapper, packing wrapper will cost you nothing.
Yeah.
As compared to maybe a jute, bag, or maybe a bag which has jute inside, you know, which will protect the clothes for like a longer period of time, you know, through the many, many climate kind of situations it can go through, right? But that investment is going to make that brand A, respected, because respect is everything in terms of fashion today. If as young people, we don't respect you if you don't care about our future, if you do not have ended us, in this climate catastrophe that we face and we have to face for the continuing years of our life and next generations, as young people, we are not able to respect you anymore because you have been exposed for what you have done to people. You know, realizing it or not realizing it. So I think it is those small scale homegrown brands who are, you know, I've seen these brands coming, you know, again, homegrown using plastic free packaging. I have this brand, Buna, which sent me their sari to wear for something. And the plastic, the packaging that it came from was a compostable. So if I put that in the soil, it would decompose. It will biodegrade. Or if I look at, you know, a platform like Saratoria, it's moving in a circular kind of economy. It's making things circular. You know, you've bought that piece, now you're not going to use it, sell it, resell it. And it will keep reselling until, you know, it has completed its life cycle. So to keep it out of the landfill. So I think there are many, many initiatives, you know, like from homegrown brands just here, including Sond, which is doing great work in terms of, you know, retailing of Indian salwars and kurtas and lehengas and, you know, like just embracing that kind of tradition, making it more modern. And like many brands that I could probably like not even think of right now, but ultimate privilege, you know, and of them showing us that, okay, upcycling, recycling, reselling, 7 hours of sustainability, and, you know, how the plastic packaging problem could be solved. You should look at them and see, because they are making their entire business model as circular and green as it can be. And I think that's definitely a lesson that the rest of the world should take, and especially the bigger brands can take from them.
Yeah, I think it would be great to kind of do a story on each of these brands and how they are starting their business from scratch.
We can depend on Ikivi to do that, because you who put brands on the map around the world. So we wait for you to do that.
Yes, for sure. We love telling stories. And I think that that's really important to communicate stories of the makers of the products, to encourage people to really buy into the whole concept of the product, as opposed to just buying, using, throwing. You buy into the whole story of it, which in turn kind of makes you preserve it, cherish it, you know, keep it safely, wash it properly. So it kind of, you ensure the customer will handhold that product through its life cycle. That's something that we try to do with Ikivi, but it's very, very challenging to communicate that and kind of work against fast fashion brands, right? Because they are talking, they're the big guns.
They're the big guns in terms of how cheap they are. Fast fashion is only cheap because someone else pays for it. You pay nothing for it. You are buying at no cost.
Yeah.
But like a question for you that I have, I'm sure I'm not allowed to have it like on a podcast as such, but do you think like sustainability, you know, because it's always a argument that it's expensive. Sustainability comes at a price. It's expensive. And so does fast fashion. But, you know, sustainability comes at a price which is higher. So how, you know, if you are a platform which is basically acting as an assortment of all these sustainable brands, you know, around, you know, which could be a part of something bigger and have more viewing and have more, you know, awareness on them. Do you think that sustainability is expensive is always going to be a hurdle for people to actually indulge in it completely?
I think initially it is going to be expensive for many reasons. One is because we're used to those cheap prices. Two is because we're constantly having that need to shop. So I think until and unless it becomes a slightly more popular requirement and becomes more mass, until then it is going to seem expensive. The reason it is expensive is because of the quality of products. It's because of the way it's made, by who it's made. Everybody is paid fairly. It comes from, you know, the right sources and things like that. But it is expensive because we are comparing it to fast fashion brands. But another way for us to adopt, which a lot of people talk about, and I think that is very important for us to make that change, is to buy secondhand and buy vintage. At least to start making that change if it is unaffordable at this point. I mean, the fact is it is expensive. So not everybody can buy into it. But this is some way that, you know, people can be a part of the movement and not really have the difficulty of buying things. And of course, buying less is something that is, you know, important. And I feel like buying less is also, I would question myself and be like, why buying less? Okay, but like, I do want to buy things. But I think what has really helped me and has helped a lot of people is figuring out ways to style different things. I think that brings that newness that we crave. So I think that that's another interesting way to kind of make that change. Yeah.
So I think it's like sustainability starts at home. It's like the most sustainable that you have is the one already in your wardrobe. So why don't you start sort of upcycling it, maybe recycle it, pair it up with a different kind of thing and just see how it goes from there, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think it's definitely a whole conversation, you know, around how it can be expensive, but I feel like sustainability is just easy because we have, it definitely means, you know, it now does not really move away from the idea that sustainability and style cannot coexist, because they can, and there are people who have made sure that they show you how that can be done. I think that it's more like it can start at home. You don't have to spend a lot to become sustainable. I think at the end of the day, it's the mindset and your intention to do better for yourself, for your planet, and for people around you. And just having that kind of awareness and consciousness, I feel like that somebody who has probably not the most sustainable dress to wear, but has the most sustainable mindset, for me is the most sustainable, most cool person.
I agree. That because it kind of permeates through all areas of your life. So whether you're mindful in terms of the way you treat yourself to where the way you buy clothing, there is that correlation as well, for sure. So I have one last question for you. Is there any message or call to action you would like to convey as a fashion activist to your audience as well as our audiences in terms who are interested in advancing sustainability in the fashion industry?
I think for me, it's always been like, choose people over profit and planet over anything else. And I think the biggest mistake that we did as a generation, or maybe our previous generation, is that they chose profits. And because they chose profits are the reason that we today face we are faced with these devastating kind of floods. The entire Himachal Pradesh, I could not have imagined Himachal Pradesh to look the way it did in the recent, you know, monsoon times, and the way buildings collapsed. And, you know, so many of my friends were also like sort of stuck there, either vacationing or either just, you know, their homes are there. And it's not like something, it's not a future. Like climate is not a future. The climate crisis is not a future threat, but something that we are living with, you know, presently. And I think just to be conscious as to what makes things the way they are, what is causing these heat waves, these unprecedented climate changes. It is September, Nivi. It's almost second week September. And we are at 40 degrees. There is no onset of winters. So this is not something that's being told to you by a tale of stories that, oh, mm-hmm. I heard from this and, you know, that happens. No. When we speak this, we are speaking because somebody right next to our house or, you know, 100 kilometers from where I am, this is happening. It is a reality of people today that they are facing this. And I think at the end of the day, we have to come and stick out for each other and act together and be unified, because the time to be divided is over. The time to be against each other or to be seen who's at the top of what industry is so done. Because I think it's truly said that people at the top today are collaborating and not competing. So if you look at people at the top who makes it, you know, through the roof, are the people who believe in power of collaboration, who believe in the power of people and unification. And I think as a young person, you know, in this entire complex and sometimes mentally exhausting and gives you a lot of anxiety to just be in those conversations and see what's happening, you know, and we're all going to die because people chose profits over people. Is this going to be our reality? So the anxiety is real. The pressure is real. And all that I want to say is that people should get away with the idea of, you know, competing anymore, but collaborating, because the power of collaborations is immense. It's huge. And I want people to know that in unification, you know, being together is our power. And especially when you come from a global South country, you should know that sticking out for each other, being there for each other is the ultimate way of being alive in today's crazy kind of scenario. As a fashion enthusiast, I definitely feel that being a fashionable person does not mean that you have to just follow trends and, you know, embrace every new thing that comes, but to just find your own personality. So for example, you know, I have an obsession with kind of wearing white shirts. And then I started looking for ways of how I can, you know, recycle my white shirts, or because how many can you buy? Mm-hmm. And what is the footprint of my shirt on this environment? I have to look at it. And that is something that I didn't look when I was 18 or 19. Yeah. I didn't probably think about that. But now, you know, I want to be more conscious. Even if that is something which says signature Aishwarya to me, like, oh, I love wearing shirts, I want to look at ways of how my obsession with my shirts and my signature style does not cost anybody, you know, their life. So, yeah.
I love that. Thank you so much, Aishwarya, for having this conversation with me today. You have shared some really valuable insights and also inspired us in so many ways. I'm excited for people to listen into this conversation and take action in whatever way they can.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the EKV podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The EKV podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at EKV.